The Park City School District met last night, and in studio with us, we have board member Andrew Kaplan, community relations specialist Molly Miller, and school district administrator Todd Haber to give us the details. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
So start times was a huge issue last night, both for public input standpoint and start time survey and the transportation consultant's finding. So a lot of discussion around using two or three bell schedules and what the cost differences would be if start time changes went to a two bell schedule. What is the holdup on this?
Yeah, so it's a more complicated process than it would so appear. You know, we have a three bell schedule, and you know, what we have a motion you know, to do by next fall, so not this coming school year, but by next school year, is to change the start times to accommodate a later start time for our adolescent students and, you know, our high school students. So the idea is that there's a lot of medical science behind having those start times later, and that's something we want to do. The trade-off, however, if we keep a three-bell schedule, is that by accommodating our older students, we are going to make it a much earlier start for our younger students, which has a whole other, you know, set of problems associated with it. So what we've been doing, you know, Todd commissioned a transportation study. We've looked at trying to optimize our start times. There's a certain amount of turnaround time for our buses. And, you know, now we're at the point where we have to consider, okay, do we move to a two-bell schedule where everyone starts a little bit later, and that has a cost associated with it of about $1 million a year in ongoing costs. So, you know, the good news is we're in our budget season right now, and we're looking at all these issues. I'd bucket it in the mental health issue because that's really what it is. It impacts the mental health of our students in terms of having them, you know, not get enough sleep. And as a board, we've prioritized mental health, and we're, you know, in the superintendent's budget, we're spending almost $3 million on new positions, you know, in terms of school psychologists and social workers and counselors to really address what's a community issue, and that we're working with the community, you know, the city, the county on, you know, to address mental health needs in our community. And it's a big priority. I think the question for the board is, okay, does that need to go into this year's budget? You know, do we need to start acquiring more buses and looking at that, or do we roll it to next year's budget because really it's not going to be implemented till the fall of 18? And that's kind of the discussion that we're having now. You know, it's everyone is very passionate about it both ways. You know, when we have the start time later, it also impacts you know, our athletes at the high school level having to leave early and things like that. But look, I mean, you know, we're trying to be as flexible as we can. We realize there's a hefty price tag with it, and we're just trying to prioritize that price tag with the other mental health initiatives that we're trying to get through in the budget this year. So it's in process. It's still on track for, you know, the fall of 2018, as it's been for the past several months. So that hasn't changed. And we are having it as a decision item on the June 6th meeting agenda. So our next official board meeting, or our next, you know, regularly scheduled board meeting, I should say. And we should be able to hopefully reach a conclusion then and put it in stone how we're going to fund it and where that funding is going to fall in terms of the timeline.
Well, isn't the priority education? I mean, above all else, is that the top priority, or is it transportation or athletes?
Well, I think in education, there's a lot of different inputs that go into that. And, you know, one of them is, you know, we look at the whole child. And so it's obviously, you know, what happens in the classroom is paramount. But what gets kids ready to be able to learn in the classroom is increasingly important. And as we, you know, as we learn more about, you know, these types of things, and it's nationwide, these conversations are happening, it becomes apparent that these are very important in terms of getting our kids able to learn. And so that's why it's significant. You know, we're also looking at, you know, specific education spending, and we're adding some teaching positions in this year's budget. And we're also looking at, you know, the compensation of all of our employees of the district. And that's a very important thing for us, and it's one of our top priorities. So, yes, the answer to your question is yes. education is paramount, but getting our kids in a position where they can learn is also important.
So in the study, Todd, that was done, it applies to all school ages, not just high school students. It's also the elementary school students that show that later start times
Correct.
Are beneficial.
Yeah, so mostly we're looking at the adolescents. That was the focus of the health studies and what's out there in the scientific field. The transportation study, though, was looking more at the logistics. How do we get the students from their homes to the schools at the right times? And that's why there was a variety of options. There are different ways to look at this and make it work. So that was mainly the focus, is what can we do, what is feasible.
So, Molly, is it just a question of money, how much it will cost for additional buses? Andrew mentioned, the question came up, do we need to buy more buses?
That's such a great question. And really, I feel like it comes down to what the community wants. And that's really what we're trying to look at. Is the community willing to invest for a 2-bell schedule? Do they want to keep a 3-bell schedule? So there's a survey out right now. It closes at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, May 21st. So I'd encourage everyone to go out. It's right on the homepage of pcschools.us. We really want to know what the community wants. And really, the purpose of this survey was to find out, when faced with these three options for the 3-bell schedule, if people would prefer no change, and if the majority or the plurality of people preferred no change, really, then it's on us to really find out whether the community wants to invest that money on a 2-bell schedule.
And how much is that study going to sway you?
The study? I'm not sure, actually. And that's a great question for the community to find out. I know that it's a very thorough study with a lot of numbers, a lot of graphs. It's taken me a while to get through it, and I would encourage people to reach out. We actually have a text system where folks can text me their questions specifically. To sign up for that, you just text your first and last name to 435-602-4444. Don't do it while you're driving. And all that info is right on pcschools.us too. So any questions about that study, any questions about the survey, text me and I'll get you the answers.
Is that why you're carrying two phones?
I know. It's so silly. I always have them.
Okay. So were you swayed at all by the number of people who spoke out at the meeting last night about just putting the start time changes in place and acknowledging the science that shows adolescents need to get more sleep and they need later start times?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our job as elected school board officials is to represent the community, and that's our role, right? So we love it when people come to our meetings and talk to us about their opinions. And, if people are silent, then, we can't hear them, right? So whether they come to our meetings or they send us emails or they call us, we always welcome all input and feedback. And, we know that everyone, who has high school kids, for the most part, or the majority of them, want their kids to start later, right? We have an opt-out available for kids currently at the high school, and I think there's around 400 kids who take advantage of that, 300 or 400 kids right now, which is a solid percentage of our students. But it's up to the community to tell us what they preference and what their priorities are. But at the same time, we also don't want to accommodate 1,200 high school kids by putting out 1,400 elementary school kids, right? Because then we're going to, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul. So that's where I am specifically, and I think the board is struggling with, okay, we've looked and tried to find a budget-neutral solution to this. Because, again, the other complication is we're going to be doing grade realignment in a couple of years, and as we build new facilities, where our students are is going to change as well. And so that will require another overhaul of the transportation program. So our initial goal was to do this budget neutral so that when we go and do it again in a couple of years, we're not just, throwing money at it. But I think what's clear now is that, my own personal opinion is that if we want to get a solution that, can accommodate all students, it's going to cost the district money. And I think that's what we're trying to do. We still are looking at these budget neutral solutions, and we may find something that works on a temporary basis in between now and when we get the grade realignment. And I think that's, you know, the other possibility. And that's what we'll use that survey for, to try to determine whether or not that's a possibility or not.
And I do want to go back and thank everybody who did participate in public comment last night. It was one of the most robust public comment sections I've ever seen. And we had a student participate, and I think I can speak for almost everyone in the room. That was the coolest part of the night. I want to give a shout out to Lance and encourage any other students who want to participate in public comment. It's a fun thing to do, and really hearing all the voices is so important. Like Andrew said, if you're silent, we can't hear you.
So how much weight would students carry versus their adult?
Oh, you know, I think everybody carries weight. I wouldn't, you know, try to attribute more weight to one group or the other, but certainly we love to hear from the students. We encourage them to be part of this process.
Well, the students are living all of the choices that the board and the district is making.
It's going to impact every single person in this district.
Okay, moving on to the bond discussion. Do you feel the master planning process and the plan itself answers enough questions, such as how big our schools should be and where they should be located?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a lot of, as you know, as Molly mentioned, there was a lot of great public comment last night, and I think it was probably my favorite meeting so far since I've been on the school board. And you know, what's clear is there's a lot of questions about from the community about our long-term values and goals and what we want our school district to look like. Things like, what do we want our ideal school size to be? How big do we want our schools? What do we want our graduates to look like? What different pathways do we want to provide for our graduates? And these are all, you know, very key questions that I think we need to decide as a community. And that's what we're trying to do, is start a dialogue, an open dialogue with everyone in the community who has interest in participating, and answer those questions so that we have direction, you know, for the next 5 or 10 years beyond. You know, we all know that we have immediate facility needs. That's undeniable. I don't think there's anyone who disagrees on that. We all know that we want to have small class sizes in our community. There's no one who disagrees about that. There's certain things that we all know and take, you know, as fact. But there's other things that, you know, we need to discuss as a community. And when you have larger schools, you can offer more programs. There's more opportunities, you know, within those schools for different tracks and things like that. But you also lose something when you have larger schools. And, you know, there's something to be said for a smaller environment, a smaller cohort. So, you know, what we need to determine, I think, is what are the community's true priorities today? Because even if we've done studies in the past, I think we can all acknowledge that the community has changed. You know, even over the last 10 years, it looks very different. The where people are moving from is very different. You know, our student growth is continuing to increase. And we need to do a thorough rehash and figure out what it is, you know, in terms of long-term planning that are our priorities. And I'm really excited that many of our community members have come in and volunteered their time and stepped up and wanting to be involved in this. And, you know, I think the difference, a lot of people say, well, what's the difference between last bond and this bond? And one of the big differences is the school board as a priority is working with our community partners, including the city and the county, to align our priorities, as well as engaging with all voices, including the dissenting voices, to look at, you know, okay, what's important to all members of our community, not what is, you know, what do we think as five school board members, you know, makes the most sense for our community and our kids. It's more, you know, what is the community's priorities? And that's where we're, you know, because ultimately these buildings and, you know, are the community's buildings. They're not the school board's buildings.
Well, I know there's been concern about building a new fifth, sixth grade school. Was there community input on this last night?
On the 5-6 school? So mm-hmm. That one didn't come up specifically. More the broader idea of a master plan. How does that work and coordinate with a strategic plan as the school board moves forward with these long-term visions of where the school district needs to be.
Were you surprised by anything last night, Todd?
I appreciated all the comments. I'm rarely surprised. Sometimes I'm shocked, but I'm rarely surprised. Because we spend a lot of time talking with individuals to know what those issues are. So as staff, we kind of feel compelled to know what the conversations are so that as we go through our deliberations and make recommendations to the board, we've at least taken into account those different ideas. And we may not attribute them to individual groups, but we have at least understood what those ideas are as we make recommendations.
And speaking of the high school expansion, did the board know what size of school is best for this age group, best for learning and the whole student that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I mean, you know, the high school is obviously getting larger because we're moving the ninth grade in. I think the plans as they're drawn are, you know, they're able to accommodate between 2,000 and I think 2,300 students, something like that, depending on the utilization and the classroom size. I think as a district, what we've discussed is that we don't want it to be over 2,000 students. I think the community question is, okay, is 2,000, you know, the right number, or is that even at that level, is it too big? And do we want to start thinking about, you know, other options, or start the planning of what another high school down the line would look like should we continue to grow? And I think we, you know, there's plenty of high schools around the country that are 2,000 and that are over 2,000 students, and you know, they're doing just fine. You know, I'd point out that our high school is an excellent high school. We were just, you know, named again and the top 500 in the country, and you know, we're ranked one or two in the state of Utah depending on the study. You know, and these are Washington Post and U.S. News studies. So, you know, we're very proud of the high school. We're trying to make it better. We're trying to do that while incorporating the ninth grade into the high school. And it's a fluid process. I think as a community, we need to decide if we continue to grow like we've been growing, you know, what does that look like? Because I don't think anyone wants to have a mega high school, you know, at the expense of the students.
Right. Well, our time is up. Is there any last thoughts you'd like to share before we go?
Yes, I'd love to really encourage everyone to sign up for that text platform. It's PCSD Community Link, and it's powered by a local startup, Atlas RTX. Text your first and last name, 435-602-4444, 435-602-4444. And certainly we'll be pushing out the information on community engagement sessions, town halls, and so on, just to really make sure we're gathering that community input and vision.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Board Member Andrew Kaplan, Community Relations Specialist Molly Miller, and School District Administrator Todd Haber. When we come back, but now on the Local News Hour, Park City Municipal Corporation will be honoring the annual Historic Preservation Award winners following the Coffee with Council at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, May 23rd at the Park City Library. In studio to give us a preview is Historic Preservation Planner Anya Gran and Board Member Lola Beetlebrox. Thank you so much for coming in, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. So tell me, what are the requirements for a building to be submitted for consideration?
Well, right now the staff is just submitting the applications for our awards, but basically it's a project that gets completed in the calendar year of 2016 for the current awards, and it's just, you know, projects that we think they did a really good job either restoring the building or reconstructing it or, you know, maintaining. In the case of the California Comstock, it was the amount of work that went into reconstructing portions of that building and stabilizing it so that it continued to maintain its ruinous state, but at the same time you could you know, see what that building was really supposed to look like.
And how many were considered this year?
We considered five, and we gave all five awards. However, we only pick one, the best one, to commission an art piece. And so we have a woodblock painting coming that's going to depict the California Comstock, and it's going to hang in the halls of City Hall along with all the other beautiful paintings that we've done in the past.
And so what stood out about this particular building?
Well, the California Comstock, of course, is up in Park City Mountain Resort, and it is it's a relic of the times. When you look at that building, you remember the mining era because it embodies the mining era. You know, ore would go from the top of the mill to the bottom, so it has that slanted roof. And Vail really stepped up to the plate, donating $50,000 to restore this very neglected piece of our history. And anybody now can go up and see it because, of course, you can go up in the summer as well in the winter if you're not a skier. So it's really special to have our mining infrastructure restored.
So I know this award is not meant to be in competition with the Park City Museum. Do they complement each other? Are they partnered? How does that work?
We're not necessarily partnered, but I think we do complement each other in, like, you know, the project of the California Comstock. The Park City Museum was instrumental in helping connect Vail to the right resources, and Clark Martinez, who did a lot of the work on the building. And so they do play a big part in preservation in our community, and they do, you know, help us out both with providing historical information and photographs, but also they're great resources, or a resource as far as, like, knowing local contractors and people that can do the work and help out.
So how long does it take to restore one of these buildings?
It really just depends on the project. Some of the houses probably take about a year or two to get done. Something like the California Comstock moved a little bit quicker, and they were able to do a lot of the work last summer.
Okay. And aside from a plaque, is there a monetary award for?
There isn't. You just get a really pretty bronze plaque to put on your building and the painting in City Hall.
Well, I understand City Hall is getting quite the collection.
We are.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So if you walk on the main level of City Hall or even upstairs, you can see a lot of the paintings of different historic buildings around town. A lot of them have been done by local artists like Jan Perkins, Bill Cransdover, Dory Pratt. Others are from artists from out of state. But basically, it's just a collection of, you know, buildings that we want to highlight that they've done, you know, some kind of excellence in restoration and have just really made, you know, contributed to our community's preservation efforts.
So you can also, you can see High West Distillery was one of them, the Washington Schoolhouse Hotel, the garage at 101 Prospect. We honor outbuildings as well as regular houses. 562 Main Street, Fletcher's, that was a really excellent example on Main Street, which is an important street for everybody to see.
And can you tell me how many buildings have been part of this award? How long has the awards been going on?
So the award started in 2011, and I think our current count with this year's award winners is up to 14.
14 winners. It's getting quite the collection.
It is, yeah. It's getting busy. We're going to have to find some more wall space here pretty soon.
So why did we start the awards? What are we accomplishing here?
So initially, when it started in 2011, it was really to showcase that projects were using the design guidelines, which were new at the time because they had been adopted in 2009. And so it was really just in an effort to kind of promote the design guidelines and you know, showcase some of the great restoration projects that occurred under those guidelines. And I think we continue to do that, but we also just really want to highlight, you know, preservation in the community and promote the projects that are doing a really good job of it.
And I don't imagine the winners go to, like, a state level or anything.
No, some of them, though, we have nominated for Heritage Awards through Preservation Utah, and a couple of them have received awards. This past year, Preservation Utah honored the McPolin Barn as well as the California Comstock with their Heritage Awards.
And what has been unexpected for you about this process, being more involved in preserving historic buildings?
Oh, man, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a fun part of my job. I get to work with artists instead of contractors for doing this project. But, no, I think it's just a really great way to showcase some of the work that's going around town, and that's what's important to me. But I'm sure Lola can speak more to it because she's participated almost as long as I have at this point.
Well, I don't know if it's unexpected, but as a member of the Historic Preservation Board, I am so overwhelmed by the people who are actually doing the restoration, the owners, because they are putting their heart and soul and pocketbooks into this and going through rigorous historic design guidelines to develop something that our entire community can care about.
Well, I know this is not part of this, but there has been talk about the A-frames, the ski. Are those going to be considered?
I think we are still discussing it and determining whether or not we should be looking at those as our next era to preserve in Park City.
Okay. Is there anything you'd like to add before we go?
I think I'm great. Thank you much for hosting us and helping us talk about this.
Absolutely. So you'll be with Coffee with Council May 23rd at the Park City Library at what time does it start?
The awards thing will start at 5:30, but I believe the Coffee with Council starts at 4 or 4:30.
Oh, okay.
And it's available on the city's website as well.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming in. That is the Historic Preservation Planner, Anya Gran, and board member Lola Beetlebrox. When we come back, we'll talk to Wasatch County NYMCA of Northern Utah. So school is almost out and parents are looking for summer programs for their kids. Wasatch County NYMCA of Northern Utah, Gus and Rachel are here. Christina couldn't make it, I guess.
Yeah, she's our office manager. So yes, she's manning the phone and making phone calls, getting ready for the summer.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much for coming in. So summer is almost here. It doesn't look like it.
Yeah, it's
school
snowing.
Is almost out. So tell me about the summer programs you guys have coming up.
So we have a couple of different programs that we do. We run camps, both overnight camps and day camps. So our day camp here in Park City, this is going to be the first summer that we're running it in this location. We're really excited about it. And Gus here is actually going to be the director over that particular day camp.
Yeah, so it's a camp Monday through Friday. I believe it's 9 to 4:30, I believe. And yeah, and we pick up and drop off is at the community church here in Park City. And
the whole idea of the camp is that it's an excursion-based program that gets kids out of their house and sometimes even out of the city, gets them to brand new places. So we take them up into the mountains to our overnight camp locations. We take them to the pool. We take them to state parks. We're going to be working with the National Ability Center and getting them doing activities there. Different things that they're not going to do during the school year, and a much better option than sitting at home on the couch, obviously, much healthier, gets them socializing with other kids. It's a really, really cool experience that we offer.
And so what ages of kids are we?
I think it starts as young as 6 and as old as 15.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when can people start enrolling, and how much is it to enroll in the programs?
The great thing about the YMCA is that we do a lot of different financial aid. So there's a whole range of prices that you can qualify for. A full price is $225, and that includes all of our field trip costs. And it also offers generally longer days than a lot of the other day camps do. You can add extended care so that your kid can come as early as 8 a.m. and stay as late as 5 p.m. So full cost is $225, and our enrollment is open now at ymca.org. You can go online today, or you can call us and get your kid registered for anywhere from 1 week all the way up through 9 weeks and give them a whole summer full of fun.
And the $225 covers?
That covers field trip costs, entrance to the pool. All they have to do is bring a lunch every single day, and we take care of everything else.
And that's for a week?
Yes, okay. For 1 week.
And how many kids are there per counselor?
We try to keep the ratio around 1 to 10. 1 to 15 is the most that we ever do, but our ratio is usually closer to 1 to 10.
Okay, and what are people usually surprised about when they bring their kids for the first time?
I think our counselors bring a lot to our program. We hire usually college-age kids. We have at least one counselor who's from another country, and it brings just a whole different aspect of culture to the kids. It exposes them to a lot of things. We've had multiple parents that say that the YMCA is a great way that their kids get some diversity in their life. They're going to meet people that they never would before. And having these really energetic counselors that are so excited to spend all day long hanging out with these kids and being really good role models to them, I think it's one of our strongest points of our program.
So I know you're in Park City, obviously, and
yes.
Weber. What are all the areas that you cover?
We have, I want to say, 4 different locations up in Weber County. We also have one in Salt Lake, and then we have a day camp with a very similar format just over in Heber that does the same excursion-based idea where we take them someplace different every single day.
So do you take kids with handicaps as well, or what are the limitations of...
Physical handicaps are limited just because we take them to a lot of rustic settings. Our overnight camps are very old, that we've been running out of Camp Roger for 70 years, and our new facility, Mill Hollow, has been running for over 50 years. But in terms of any kind of, we can work with kids with ADHD, any kind of a mental or emotional struggles. We just encourage parents to call us and talk to us, and we can let them know exactly how we'll work with our kids and learn from them what's going to help your kid out best so that we can give them the best experience right off the bat.
So is that only for the overnight camps, or is that...
Nope, that's for all of our camps as well.
Okay. And for the overnight camps, do you keep the boys and girls separated? How does that work out?
Yes. So basically we have separated by cabins. Specifically Camp Roger, we have Actually, it's kind of L shape. Yeah, the girls on the right and the boys up top. And we have 15 cabins. So we split it up, boys and girls.
And so do you have volunteers who come and help out with these camps?
We always get some volunteers. Last year, actually, we had a couple of our staff that flew back from other countries because they loved camp so much and wanted to be a part of it. Most of our staff are paid counselors, but we always are welcome to have volunteers. We've been running overnight programs in the area at Camp Roger for almost 70 years now, and again at Mill Hollow. This will be our first summer running out of that facility. The Granite School District has ran programming there for the last 50 years.
Yeah, and as for like volunteers, we do have a camp cleanup day on June 3rd is a Saturday. We do have we usually local volunteers to come up, help camp get ready, clean up, fix up trails. We usually try to reach out to a lot of alumni if they're in the area. And that's a big volunteer opportunity that we have at Camp Roger specifically.
And about how many kids do you guys take care of each summer?
About 130 to 150 a week. So a little over 1,000 kids throughout 9 weeks of camp.
Mm-hmm. And it starts when?
June 11th is the first week of camp. And we go straight through Sunday through Friday till August 11th.
Mm-hmm. Sunday through Friday?
Sunday through Friday, yes.
Yeah, so Camp Roger, they get dropped off Sunday afternoon, picked back up Friday evening, so they are there for 6 nights and 5 full days. Mill Hollow, which starts July 8th, we're just running 4 sessions there. That camp is a little bit longer. It's for older kids, and it's designed to give them a little bit more of an in-depth camp experience. So that one, we do a pick-up and drop-off Saturday mornings, and it runs Saturday through Saturday. So they get 7 full nights and 7 full days.
Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we go?
Yeah, no. If you want any more information, ymca.org, ymcautah.org, or give us a call.
Yeah, we love talking to parents, talking to them about their child specifically and helping them figure out exactly what's going to be the best program for them.
And what is your phone number?
801-839-3379.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much. That's Rachel and Gus from Wasatch County and YMCA of Northern Utah and YMCA. And when we come back, we'll hear from Park City Community and Public Affairs Manager Linda Jaeger and former Park City Council Member Liza Simpson. We'll be back in a moment.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Thank you so much for coming in, ladies. We're going to talk about the event you're doing tonight with the Park Record. I'm just going to totally wing this since I've thrown off my groove. For people who are interested in running for city council, can you tell us about tonight's event, Linda?
Sure. It's actually a biennial event. So the last time the Park Record and Park City hosted this was in 2015. So we're back again this year, previewing and talking about what it takes to run for office for the 2017 election. It will be 5 to 7 p.m. this evening at Miners Hospital, free and open to the public. So we really encourage folks to come out and learn everything they wonder about running for office.
How big of a turnout did you have last year?
You know, I believe 2 years ago, I believe there were about 50 people, and we're expecting about the same, if not more, tonight, getting the word out. And I think it's a, you know, great way to spend 2 hours and learning how you can get more involved in your community. There are also several other seats up in towns in Summit County, so we'll be talking a little bit about that as well. And the deputy recorder from Summit County, Kelly Robinson, will also be there to answer questions about things outside of Park City.
Oh, great. So, Liza, you're a former board member, city council.
City council member, yep.
Yeah. What does it take to run for city council?
You know, I think what it takes is really wanting the job. And that's why I'm really pleased that the Park Record and the city are doing these orientation meetings, because it's a wonderful way for people to get an idea of what it's going to take without having to jump in with both feet. I mean, it's a big time commitment once you're elected. If you're elected, it's a big time commitment to campaign. You kind of got to put yourself out there and not be afraid about putting yourself out there. So I think it's wonderful. They weren't doing it when I was running for office the first time, but I was lucky enough to have worked for a former city council member, Hugh Daniels, who's now the emergency manager. And so I had a really pretty good idea of exactly what it was going to take time-wise as a commitment, you know, and the time commitment depends on how much you want to commit to it. I did have doubts about being able to sit still. So when I was thinking about running the first time, I started going to the work sessions and staying till the bitter end of every city council meeting because I just wasn't sure I could keep my butt in the chair that long. It's a wonderful chance for people to understand what the running process is and what the job entails before committing.
So you were on council for 8 years?
Yep.
Okay. So what didn't people tell you? What didn't you know before you went in that you wish you had?
I guess I would have to say just how much closed session stuff that our city has to deal with. You know, that's property, personnel, and litigation. And so, you know, some of it's obviously positive, right? Buying land for affordable housing or discussing buying open space, that's all fun. I just didn't expect to have that much of that, especially in such a transparent community.
So, Linda, the window to apply for city council or mayor, that's up this year too, is June 1st through the 7th. Is
yes.
that correct?
June 1st through 7th.
And what do people need to know? What qualifications are there to run for council or mayor?
You know, that's a great question. We'll be going over all that in detail this evening about residency, city limits for running for a Park City office versus unincorporated Park City and throughout the county. So our city election official and recorder, Michelle Kellogg, will be going over all that in detail this evening.
Okay. About how many people do you think are going to come?
I know. We're, again, expecting at least 50 and welcome more. We've got plenty of room. And it's, again, going to be a great opportunity, educational opportunity. Even if you're not thinking about running this year, a lot of folks, you know, may be getting this information and run in 2019 or another time. So it's just a great foundation of information.
It also gives you a chance to learn about all of our other board and commission opportunities, because not everybody, lots of people want to serve and give back to their community, and not everybody wants to run for office. I mean, you have to raise money. As I said, you have to put yourself out there. You have to be ready to have it take a half an hour to get a gallon of milk at the supermarket, because you end up having many conversations in the supermarket. But we have lots of board and commission opportunities for people, and you'll find out more about them at this meeting, too.
And that's, as I said, a great first step. A lot of people spend time on boards and commissions as a entree into public service, and we'll have all those listed, and we're always recruiting. We actually just closed recruitment for SEAC, which is our Special Events Advisory Committee, Public Art Advisory Board, Board of Adjustment, Historic Preservation. So we're always looking for members on those committees. I'll tell you more about it tonight.
Isn't SEAC meeting today at noon?
There is a SEAC meeting today as well.
I'm on top of it.
And one more thing that I would say that I think people need to think long and hard about if they're thinking about running for office, any office, is you're part of a team. You know, and I think a lot of people go into elected positions, you know, thinking that they're going to somehow get a crown and a wand. And that's not how it works. You know, you've got to be able to listen to other people. You've got to be able to respect their opinions and be open to the fact that they might change yours. I was very lucky to have served with the people I've served with. We're very lucky to have such a experienced and cohesive council. They don't all agree. We didn't all agree. But we respected each other, and we were willing to listen to diverse opinions. And I think that's really important to do.
As I've gotten to know council, everything I hear from staff and council, the city is really in good hands because they're open to communication. Everything that you just spoke about is mm-hmm. what they reflect with each other, and what they have commented about enjoying is the relationships, not always agreeing. What advice do you have for somebody who has strong ideas, who's really committed, wants to make a difference in the community? I know we have the PECANs now who are mm-hmm. the younger adults in the community who want to get more involved. What advice do you have to them about running? And then if they do make it to council, because there are two seats available, sitting in those seats?
Well, it's a big responsibility, you know, and I think you have to, or at least I felt that on the one hand, I got elected because of who I am, right? That people liked my ideas or liked the way that I thought. But you have to set that ego aside, and you have to be able to do that. You have to recognize that you have to make the best decisions for the community, even if it's not necessarily the path you personally would choose. And I think that's one reason why I mentioned the boards and commissions, because I do think that previous board or commission service helps you function as part of a, you know, I mean, the city council is basically a board, right? And you need to be a good board member. You need to be able to listen both to your peers and your staff and your constituents. And so I don't think it needs to be a city or a county board that you have experience on, but I do think that's helpful. I mean, it could be the library board in the town you grew up in, you know, 20 years ago. But working as part of a team like that and having experience working as part of a team is super helpful. So, for example, to the Pecans.
Parks and Action Network.
Yes. Correct. Yeah. I would suggest that if they haven't done that, that maybe they apply for a board or commission or serve on a nonprofit board just to get their feet wet and see if they like doing that kind of work, because it's not for everybody. And it's not a negative reflection, you know, on them if they serve on a board for 2 years and they're like, oh, God, I don't want to do this, you know.
Okay. And I'd love to mention who will be speaking this evening. It's a great lineup of speakers. We have former Park City Mayor Brad Ulch, Park City Council members Nan Morrell and Becca Gerber, who were recently elected in the last election. Former Park City Planning Commissioner Rory Murphy will be addressing the boards and commission role, and he also ran for office. Park City Attorney Mark Harrington will talk about the legal logistics. Park City Recorder and Election Official Michelle Kellogg, as well as Deputy Clerk from Summit County Kelly Robinson on the nuts and bolts of filing and residency requirements. And then Katie Eldridge will also join us on promotion and campaign advice on running for office.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, ladies, for coming in. That was Community and Public Affairs Manager Linda Jaeger and former Park City Council Member Liza Simpson. We'll be back in a moment.